Very Bad Wizards is a podcast with a philosopher, my dad, and a psychologist, Dave Pizarro, having an informal discussion about issues in science and ethics. Please note that the discussion contains bad words that I'm not allowed to say, and knowing my dad, some very inappropriate jokes.
You're a shallow, talkative, empty-headed ne'er-do-well. And to remain silent would destroy you.
The Queen and Oz.
Welcome to Very Bad Wizards. I'm Tamler Summers from the University of Houston. Dave, I've been working on a paper. I'm at the point where I'm supposed to address some objections that I anticipate getting, kind of fussy objections. What's the scholarly equivalent of the wanking motion? I can see these objections about how I'm like conflating two different concepts, like agent regret and remorse. And I need that, you know, that thing that you can put in the paper that's just
like they should have
off.
Animated GIFs, like, yeah. in at least like PDF should support like a jerking off. You know, I don't know what the right answer is to that, but it might be something like the footnote that we have. I'm David Pizarro from Cornell University. It might be something like one of the footnotes in the article that we're reading today, which is The Totalitarian Ego by Anthony Greenwald.
Great.
The reader is asked to accept without further laboring of the argument that organization within a knowledge system facilitates blah, 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 blah. The argument might be made in rigorous fashion, but that is beyond the scope of this article.
I love that.
He was just like, jerking off.
Yeah, when he says beyond the scope of this article, he means like beneath my dignity
right.
as like, a human
that's
being.
Right. Don't be stupid. You know it's true.
So just shut the fuck up is essentially what that footnote is. No, that is great. I highlighted that too. I love that. Yeah. I took notes.
I love the passive voice. It's the reader is asked. I'm not asking you. It's just you're just being asked by some nebulous sort of like reasonable, like the rational person.
Yeah. Today we are continuing our series where one of us suggests either a classic philosophy paper or a classic psychology paper. And Dave selected for today The Totalitarian Ego. We're only doing papers about totalitarianism.
I know.
There has to be some connection to totalitarianism or else we're not doing it. But this is a fantastic paper that we'll talk about in 1 second. Before we do, we want to thank everybody who contacts us through all the various ways that you can. You can like us on Facebook. You can tweet us at VeryBadWizards, at Tamler, at Pease. You can email us, VeryBadWizards@gmail.com, and rate us on iTunes. Oh, you know, I wanted to do that. Maybe we'll do that next time. I wanted to read just some of the last reviews that we've gotten because they've been really funny, just like, and really nice.
They've been really nice. Yeah. They actually make my day when I'm feeling blue.
Yeah.
All I have to do.
So here's a couple. Very recent one from Rob to the Ryan. Born, breast milk, Fruity Pebbles, Cheerios, Bible, E.T., Meatloaf, Dorothy, sex, 16 candles, geography, soccer, Kerouac, wine, selfish gene, multigrain Cheerios, Unagi, Kubrick, Bowie, Very Bad Wizards, death.
That's poetry. That is poetry.
And I'm honored to be in that category of things, too. I mean, yeah. Maybe not Fruity Pebbles, although, you know.
Hey, man.
And I don't know what Unagi. Do you know what that is?
No.
Here's another one that I love. Although it seems like it would be repugnant to listen to a drunk that makes love to his dog chat with a Kantian philosopher. I like that you're the Kantian philosopher. I have a justified true belief that this VBW has all the sufficient and necessary attributes of a 5-star podcast. That's so great. And then just some really nice ones that I won't read because I'm uncomfortable with praise.
With heaping praise upon yourself.
Yeah.
Exactly. So you'd rather self-abuse, good old-fashioned self-abuse.
Yeah, self-abuse is the way to go. The other way you can make us happy is by supporting us, either by clicking the link at Amazon or by sending us a donation on PayPal. And you can do both of those things at verybadwizards.com/support. Click on that Amazon link before you shop and consider sending us a donation because we really appreciate it. We work hard on this and we do have some overhead as well.
Thanks for all the support. I wanted to quickly read this one. This sentence: Tamler and Dave have a chemistry like Paul and John that makes me want to listen, even if I'm not super familiar with the topic at hand. I call dibs on being John.
That's fine. You could be married to Yoko Ono.
And dead.
Did you think that that he was referring to Paul Bloom and John Haidt?
They do have a wonderful chemistry, those two.
We got a couple. I think we sounded like we were friends in the last one too, because we got a couple like tweets about that.
Somebody asked, "Are you guys best friends in real life?" And I restrained myself from saying, "No, we hate each other," because I thought it would be misinterpreted.
I mean, I think that people like the thought that turns out not to be true, that we're actually good friends. No, we are good friends. We talk to each other all the time, and we're about very personal matters sometimes, but we've literally met in person something like 4 times, right?
Yeah,
it's bizarre. That's right.
It is. We gotta do a Very Bad Wizards meetup of some sort.
Hopefully it's like Got Mail. I haven't seen You've Got Mail, so it's what I imagine You've Got Mail
is. It's like a shitty rom-com. So I had a few of our listeners approach me at this conference, and it just felt great. Some compliments just feel really great, and the biggest compliment I think of recent is that people saying that we were the ones who introduced them to Mr. Robot.
Yeah, I love those too, because those are the things that I appreciate the most, when somebody introduces me to some sort of work of art that I didn't know about before.
Yeah, you know one of the somebody tweeted out, thanks for introducing him to the comics of Brubaker, who's one of my favorite comic writers, and said that he had never read comics before that.
You introduced him to a whole genre, a whole way of living. Exactly. I never really considered being a nerd before, but thank you.
I've ruined his life. Oh, you know, last thing I wanted to say really quickly was, one of my friends who is just almost, you know, do you know how Jesus said a prophet is without honor in his own land? Sometimes I feel this way. Like, I don't get respect, the respect that I deserve from my own friends in the field.
Yeah.
So one of my friends, Kathleen Voss, you may know her from such publications as Schooler and Voss, told me that she had actually bothered to listen to a couple of our episodes. Uh-huh. And this is what she had to say. You know how somebody said that you guys, one of you sounds like you have a tampon stuck in your throat?
Yeah.
She said, David, that was definitely you. your voice caught your voice is weird. I was like, fuck you. Fuck you.
Yeah. How'd that replication go?
Burn, Kathleen. All right, so let's dive.
Is there any scenario where saying "oh snap" could possibly be anything but just lame? Like, if you're saying it ironically, saying it non-ironically, there's really no context that would be acceptable to say.
So, are you including like any version of that, like burn?
No, like sick burn. I think you know, that's something Eliza says. She says it kind of ironically, but it's kind of funny, you know.
Kids these days do everything ironically. It's really hard to keep up.
Little miniature hipsters.
They really are.
Did you watch Grease live?
No.
That went See, this is where being a divorcee, you know, comes in handy. It was on in my house. I have a small house. And
you enjoyed it, don't lie.
It could have been worse. I found out, I don't know if you're like this. I know the movie embarrassingly well.
I know it better than I really would care to admit.
Then it's virtuous.
I like John Travolta in Pulp Fiction a lot more.
Yeah, but like there were parts of in the live show where I knew it was a departure from the movie, and I just shouldn't know that.
You shouldn't. It's true. Yeah. It's like when we were at a club and at the conference, and the Backstreet Boys came on, and I knew the lyrics. It was really fucking embarrassing.
That's pretty bad. That wouldn't happen to me.
You're above that.
Well, I'm not above it. You realize as you get older that you're really not above anything. I think that's the main lesson that you put on this earth to understand.
Yes. To how to deal with shame.
Yeah. All right. Speaking of, no, there's no good transition here.
There's really none.
But let's talk about this great article from 1980 called "The Totalitarian Ego" by
Anthony Greenwald.
Not to be confused with Glenn Greenwald.
Yeah. When people say he got Greenwalded, we don't mean Anthony.
Yeah, we don't need Anthony. This was a fantastic essay that I had not only not read, but never heard of. And I'm grateful for you that this was the thing that you assigned. Like, this makes me think this series is working out very well.
Yeah. No, I'm really glad I assigned this too, because I was almost made the mistake of assigning an article with actual data.
Yeah.
Which I might do next time.
Shit. I was hoping you forgot about me having to read the results section.
Yeah. I assigned it with the memory that I had of the paper that it was good and that it was big picture and that it really was prescient, but I hadn't read it in a long time. Like, I certainly didn't read it before telling you to read it. And so it really holds up. So maybe
when you say big picture, this is seriously big picture. This is like Isaiah Berlin big picture, but the psychology version, as you sort of texted me. It's incredible the breadth of this paper and the way it tries to unify all these different domains into a single kind of vision. But why don't you give the sort of main rundown, because you'll sound smarter talking than I.
Well, here's a little background. So I don't think I've ever had the chance to chat actually with Tony Greenwald, but I was aware of his work because Mazarin Banaji was a professor at Yale when I was in grad school, and I was very close with her students, and I consider her a mentor, even though I didn't really work with her. But I remember when reading in grad school, I was like, wow, you know, it just scratched that itch for me, especially as a young grad student, when you're at the stage where you're being forced to narrow, you're really being told that big picture thinking is not for you, right? What you need to do is make that incremental, you know, finding that will let you have a publication in a good empirical journal and that you'll be able to talk about in your job talk.
Purity judgments in 3-year-olds, something like that.
That's way too broad even.
Yeah.
So
3-year-old Jews. How about that?
There. Well, Ashkenazi. And I was always I'd never really been able to talk in my memory. I'd never talked to Mazarin Banaji about this paper. And I really wanted to know from him whether how he felt about this paper. Because as Mazarin pointed out, we got some good feedback from Mazarin, and then she introduced us
to talk
Tony.
About the paper first, though?
Let's talk about the paper, and then I'll get to why I was curious about his thoughts now. But the paper is essentially central to the paper is this metaphor that the mind, the human social mind, or the human mind actually, is akin to a totalitarian regime. Using this metaphor and quotes from George Orwell's 1984, he takes it very. It's like a very, very serious metaphor. And really, there's two metaphors there. The totalitarian regime that controls all information, and scientific paradigms, sort of the Kuhnian sort, and the lactose sort.
And that just sort of sneaks up on you midway through the paper. And I was like, holy shit, that's so cool. That was one of my favorite things about it is all of a sudden, like it was already, like you're already comparing just the way an individual mind works with totalitarian regimes and bringing in Hannah Arendt and Orwell. And
then
all of a sudden it's like, oh, and also like the way scientific theory construction and paradigms work.
It's an amazing synthesis of work that was just starting to go on right now. It's like this work on that had been slowly, it was new, but slowly accumulating in a variety of domains, showing that we have a set of biases that can be characterized as essentially the mind very, very selectively picking the information we remember, the information we pay attention to, the information we use, the judgments that we make, selectively picking the stuff that is good for us. Forgetting things forgetting bad things about ourselves, paying attention really to only self-relevant information, and particularly self-relevant information that makes us think that we're good people. Really capturing the sort of in the Kuhnian way, that the way in which if you really, really are pro a particular theory, you ignore the evidence that goes against you.
Can we go through the different categories of biases that he's talking about?
Yeah.
The way which they map on to a totalitarian political regime. So the three biases that he talks about are egocentricity, benefactance, and conservatism. Egocentricity. So what is that?
So it's the view that the self is more important than it probably really is, that it's more central.
So what are the kinds of biases that
he calls it? Sort of an ego as a self-focused historian. Like when you're writing the history of what things that happened, you can't help but write all of the stuff that was important to you, and you pretty much tend to ignore the stuff that wasn't important to you.
You're the central character of the drama.
Exactly. And now again, this is, I think, just an accepted view of the human mind, whether or not you adopt this totalitarian metaphor. So he talks about
Feel like you're more in control, right?
You're way more likely to see yourself as a causal force. He talks about these famous studies by Alan Langer on the illusion of control, right? You're way more likely to see that you were a causal force in whatever, especially good outcomes. But it's not always good, because you can actually have this bias of egocentricity really explode into paranoia. For instance, the thinking that everybody's out to get you, when in reality, no one really gives a fuck.
Right.
a lot
spotlight
of
spotlight effect is probably part of this.
I was about to say, Tom Gilovich here from Cornell, and the spotlight effect, you really, you know, this is where he had people wear Barry Manilow t-shirts and estimate how many people saw them in a classroom. And they think like everybody was clearly looking, but really no one gives a fuck about your shit, you know?
Just focused on you.
Yeah. No one cares that much about you.
The best example of that is when I wear my Very Bad Wizards t-shirt and I imagine in people's minds, like, A, they've heard of the podcast. B, that they're judging me for wearing the shirt. Like,
right.
Like, who does he – that's kind of lame, or who does he think?
Yeah.
And none of those things.
Yeah, like no one gives a fuck. Like really? You think that people both know what the podcast is and know that you're a host when you wear it?
All right. So the second category of bias is benefactance. Yeah.
Which is a term that he coins, which is intended.
Not one that's caught on.
It's not one we got to say of the things that lasted.
Yeah.
It's a compound of beneficence, achieving desirable outcomes, and effectance, motivation to act competently. My favorite example of this is under a section that he talks about informal observations. So basically, this is a bias where you see yourself as causally responsible for good things, that you're competent to achieve, to have control over, to achieve good things. But when the bad thing happens, you sort of like, you're like, oh, well, that was just chance. So he has, again, in very sort of big picture thinking, he has a section on informal observations. And I love this example. In automobile driving, benefactance takes the form of reluctance to acknowledge responsibility for various mishaps. The following quotations from a collection of drivers' explanations of accidents to police give some amusing illustrations. quote, "As I approached the intersection, a sign suddenly appeared in a place where a stop sign had never appeared before. I was unable to stop in time to avoid an accident. The other one is the telephone pole was approaching. I was attempting to swerve out of its way when it struck my front end." The telephone pole took a few hops and a skip, and right.
That's hilarious.
And it's such a common observation when people just, you know, someone cuts you off and you yell at them like fucking assholes.
Right.
Even but when you cut.
And this is, of course, what totalitarian regimes do when they will claim credit for every good thing that happens to the community. And if something undeniably tragic happens, they will say it was unavoidable and
right.
that they did the best they could to, in spite of the horrible confluence of circumstances that led to it.
I mean, you can see this in. Even though I guess we don't have a totalitarian government, just in the way political parties take credit for, say, economic upturns. If it was, say, you're a Democrat, you and the first 4 years of a Democrat's time in office, the economy goes up. You say like, see, we've really made change. And the Republican says, no, that's just the lag from the last administration, right? And then the opposite is true, of course.
Right. If the economy goes down, then you'll say, look what happens as soon as Obama takes office. Okay. Conservatism. This is also really interesting. And
conservatism is preserving what's already there, right? So a reluctance to change your views, even given factual information. This is really, really characteristic of scientific theories, right?
You have a theory.
Yeah, no matter how much evidence that is contrary to it, you know. So we have this rationalist view of how science works, the kind that you were taught, you know, in eighth grade science or whatever, where you have a hypothesis, then you get the information and you evaluate whether it was consistent with your hypothesis and that was generated by your theory. And if it disconfirms, then, you know, there's reason to doubt your hypothesis. But as is just so painfully obvious, and we're really trying hard to fix it, this can lead you to just, with the best of intentions, completely ignore all of the evidence that is accumulated that goes against your theory.
Yeah.
Because we just really don't want to take the time to evaluate that evidence.
In the individual case, you know, there's cases of confirmation bias where you only see the things that will support your opinion and you ignore the evidence that goes against it. I was accused of that in the Mr. Robot episode. I had this.
Oh, Paul Bloom was so heated about this.
Yeah, I had this idea, and I don't think this will spoil anything because very few people agree with me, but that Tyrell is like a projection of Elliot's dad, an alternate projection. And I you know, going back through the show, I like the show is just one big confirmation of that original idea that I got. And, you know, whenever there was something that went against it, I would either grudgingly admit it and say, but figure and assume that it could be explained away or not see it.
Right. And like literally not seeing it. Right. So you don't have to attribute ill intent to know that this is just the way that you just have to know that this is the way the mind works. You're just way more likely to pay attention. And there's actually an interesting set of what at first glance seem to be contrary findings. There's all this work showing that you are selectively avoid information that goes against your view. But then there's a bunch of evidence that when you're processing information that goes against your view, that you actually think harder about it
if you're forced to process it in a certain way, right?
Yeah. And so that really if we'd rather not read something that goes against our views, but once I force you to read it, then
and make a case yourself.
Right? Yeah. Then the wheels start kicking in and you start coming up with way more reasons. You know, you think really hard about it. So you actually think harder about it if you're forced to read something that goes against your views. Like,
but then there's the different kind of bias, like which he calls the rapid aging of new opinions, and also the knew it all along effect. If for some reason you are convinced of a new view, then you're more likely to think, well, I always thought that.
Exactly.
And, you know, and I like that idea of the rapid aging of new opinions. You have this new opinion and all of a sudden it's an opinion you've had for a long time.
Yep.
Again, this has nice analogs with totalitarian. He quotes Orwell talking about this. The party member tolerates present day conditions partly because he has no standards of comparison. He must be cut off from the past because it is necessary for him to believe that he is better off than his ancestors and that the average level of material comfort is constantly rising. So you're always going to think right now that you are the best off, that you either knew it all along, or you're going to force yourself to believe that your current condition is the best condition against all evidence.
Right.
But the thing that it can't tolerate is this idea that you were wrong, they were wrong, the totalitarian government was wrong about a certain fact or a certain way that the world was going to proceed.
So there's actually some experiments that I really love that come from Linda Levine, who's at UC Irvine, and I worked with a little bit. She's a memory researcher. She does memory and emotion, and she has this really nice finding that that you misremember your emotional reactions in a large part based on how you feel about that event now.
So let's talk about what the function of all these biases are at every level of analysis that he talks about, the political, the scientific, and the individual self. So let me read a couple of quotes about knowledge organization and in totalitarian society that are relevant. So he says,
right.
This is from 1984, the reason for the readjustment of the past is... You're in the way again, Dave.
What a great example of the totalitarian ego.
Yeah, the totalitarian ego. I blamed David's Skype box for being in the way of me reading this thing.
And it was really sincere. Like you were just like kind of angry at me for
out of the fucking way. Jesus Christ. It's not my fault for not being able to operate my own computer. The reason for the readjustment of the past is the need to safeguard the infallibility of the party. No change of doctrine or in political alignment can ever be admitted. For to change one's mind or even one's policy is a confession of weakness. And then another one, the control of the past depends above all on the training of memory. It is necessary to remember that events happened in the desired manner, and if it is necessary to rearrange one's memories or to tamper with written records, then it is necessary to forget that one has done so. The trick of doing this can be learned like any other mental technique. It is called doublethink. This is Orwell again.
What a great quote.
It's just so great. And he really could be talking about this, you know, these cognitive biases. You could see from the totalitarian government, if you're going to convince people that this single ideology provides all the answers, then you're going to have to do a lot of rewriting of history, and you're going to have to convince people that they're better off than they are. But what about in the individual level?
He explicitly says, like, when people talk about this, they often say, well, it's a motivational bias. Like, well, I just want to believe I'm good. But he points out that this is not an explanation. This is just, it's just saying what the findings are. So he thinks that this kind of organization is helpful because he uses the analogy to a library where it's useful to have information organized in a way that's easy to access and use. And this kind of organization just, it's handy. Believing a bunch of things that are inconsistent makes the search for information sloppy.
So it is a way of being able to better access the information that's relevant to your life.
Yeah. Intrapsychically, I think that's the way to see it. Remembering things that are self-relevant is a really useful thing. Like remembering objective events. We know this now, decades of research on memory. We're super biased in our memory, and there are all sources of this bias, all sorts of sources of this bias, but they all kind of make sense if you view if you view the human mind as just trying to keep a consistent image or set of pieces of information about itself.
Why would the human mind want to keep a set of consistent? Why would the information about the self need to be consistent? What's the function of that? Why would we be set up?
Ready access to information that you ought to act upon, that this organization provides you. The library metaphor again, if the cards were all out of order, then it would be much harder to find the information you need to act upon.
But if the cards are misleading, as in the case of these biases, like it points you to books that aren't actually there,
right?
Then that would be less useful.
It would be,
right?
Less useful. I think reading between the lines and maybe actually just knowing what people have said after this, that it is a trade-off, right? That there definitely is a reason for accuracy. But this is the easiest way to organize.
Right. That's even in the paper, right?
I think so, yeah.
You know, and he uses the science analogy as well. After a certain point, like, dogmatically sticking to a theory is going to be harmful. So you want to have some sort of mechanisms in place that will allow that paradigm to shift, but it's still important to be able to not give up on a theory too easily.
Right.
And
right.
That's what our biases allow us to do. And I guess, yeah. And then this is, in this case of the individual, would be like a theory of the self.
Mm-hmm. There's a saying in science that theories change one funeral at a time.
Right.
And there's no good analogy for that intrapsychically.
Well, maybe it is. Maybe there's some sort of self-conception that you have of yourself that has to die. Me being a novelist.
Yeah.
Like I could fit a lot into it, but at a certain point I had to put that to rest.
I take your work as fiction. I don't think you've failed. That's right. So sometimes you just can no longer, you know, you can consider that some cases are like an intervention for a drug addict, right? Where where you're just confronted clearly with information that you can no longer ignore. But the ease with which these biases give you information that is only in your favor is a really hard, it's an uphill battle to get objective information about yourself.
So here's, I think, a paragraph that seems important. He says, to return to Lakatos's observation, the egocentricity and conservatism biases may provide a protective belt that preserves the hardcore belief that all of one's memory is the interrelated experience of a single entity, the one called myself. The protection of this belief may be a very important matter indeed. Its breakdown is considered to be a pathological condition when it occurs in the form of multiple personality, amnesia, fugue, or depersonalization. So you have to think about the alternatives. So even though the biases are work, they'll give you some false information. At the very least, they're preserving this core self conception that if you don't have that, it's anything goes. You've lost. You're Elliot. You know, you're somebody who doesn't know who they are and what they're about and doesn't know what to expect from themselves, and it's chaos. And, you know, similarly in science, if you don't have some sort of organizing theories, then you have no idea what to expect out of the world. You have no idea what you can trust. Sort of like social psychology right now.
I can't even argue. No, absolutely. And so when you think about, you know, this, I love this paragraph because it ties in the notion of identity into this, right? It's
so the analogy on the political level for the self, I think, is the ideology of the regime, right? It's like everything has to fit. You know, you consider Marxism with its description of how history works. You have to force actual history into that ideology, or else it's all
it'll
chaos.
Crumble. It'll crumble.
It'll crumble.
Right? It'll crumble.
The whole system crumbles.
This is where it makes sense to talk about what Mazreen emailed, Mazreen Banaji. Because I know her, I had emailed her originally to get some thoughts. And she says, the Totalitarian Ego was published in 1980, just as I arrived to work with Tony in the fall of 1980. It had tremendous impact on me, perhaps not for the best reasons. It was the first thing of his I read that I actually understood. Also, I had just left a deeply Marxist university. Actually was fleeing from it, so this piece was cathartic.
Yeah.
All right.
By the way, we'll post a link to this. When she says it's the first thing of his that I understood, it's a very accessible paper. I mean, it's exceptionally well written in ways that you often don't see from psychologists sometimes, you know.
Right. Just the synthesis in this paper is amazing. And I think when she says it was the first thing of his that I actually understood, that says something about, like, she was in a Marxist program, which is just to say, at least she had not been trained scientifically.
Yeah.
And so her ability to understand this stuff and make sense of it, I think is a characteristic of the papers, the paper's accessibility to all sorts of people. So yeah, there has to be a balance between objective information and accuracy and all of these biases. But I think that after this paper, maybe it just became clear that there are so many of these biases that there has to be really an advantage. It really used to be in social psychology, the older views of how we make attributions, for instance. The belief was that we are like naive scientists. We're like lay scientists. We're taking into account, say, I want to know what kind of person you are, Tamler. So I'm sort of keeping track of all of the behaviors that you emit. And I am sort of making this measurement about, okay, when you did something that was bad, was it because of the situational forces that were around you? Do you tend to do bad things no matter where you are?
I have just a rotten character.
Exactly. And so a lot of early social psychology was built on this assumption that what we're doing basically is statistics on other people.
Yeah.
And that we're doing so in a pretty rational sense. But what came out of that tradition was an increasing understanding that no, people weren't objective in the way that we paid attention to, especially our own behavior, but the behavior of others, like the fundamental attribution error and all that stuff came after we realized, like, we're pretty much not, well, in some sense, we are like scientists.
Right, exactly. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But our goal is to tell ourselves a story that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And if we really looked at the facts, the story wouldn't make any kind of sense. We wouldn't have any kind of coherent picture of behavior.
This liability, this is a quote, this liability may be more than balanced by the asset of allowing the cognitive system to allocate its resources to storage and retrieval of information rather than continual revision of its indexing or coding scheme.
Right.
And thereby permitting access to a large amount of information within a single system.
So the idea with the library where he says, let's say this new, better, more accurate library organizational system comes along, you're not going to want to just overhaul your current system. What are those things? The Dewey Decimal or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, you're not going to want to overhaul it, even if the new one would give a slightly more accurate picture. It's just, A, too much work. There is some motivation to just keep the system that you have in place right now. And that goes very well with the scientific case where, and you know, I think philosophy too, so much of this can apply to philosophical theory construction. In this case now, you're trying to preserve your theory and you'll act, and a lot of times theories are just matching intuitions about particular cases or something like that. And you have a general principle that can account for your intuitions about particular cases. All of a sudden, someone will come up with a counterexample or a set of counterexamples, and you'll find them less intuitive if they don't fit with your theory. You know, you'll preserve your theory. A lot of what I complain about in philosophy is trying to make a theory, a simple theory, out of something that's much messier and more complex. But there's some value to that. Yeah. I don't know if that works as well in philosophy, though. But maybe it does. I have to think of it.
There's no actual evidence.
Right, exactly.
To update. There's no updating.
There's no actual value of the whole project to be.
I'm trying to think of an example where, I mean, you're going to hate this, but I was trying to think of an example of where people really had to shift their philosophical, like as a field, whether there's been a paradigm shift that was due to, and all I can think of is how people thought of epistemology after Gettier cases.
I mean, that's an example of something that just never should have gotten started in the first place. But here's an example, like with Singer, took it upon himself to believe, to shift from a Humean conception, which would be too subjective for what he wanted, to this kind of Parfit conception, objectivism about an objective foundation for his utilitarian, very strong utilitarian beliefs. And Peter Singer is a brilliant guy. And
yeah,
he makes, there are certain leaps that he makes that are in a way not, they stand out in his work as, how can you really believe that, you know? But the point is, like he can believe it because it allows him to put forth this massive theory, which has led to the effective altruism movement, and which has changed the course of like human history in a lot of ways. I mean, he's one of the philosophers that really can lay claim to have done that with animal welfare and with the way people regard their philanthropic obligations. And if you have to make a few unjustified meta-ethical assumptions, like maybe that's not the biggest deal in the whole world.
It's akin to the footnote. Dear reader, please don't worry about this.
Yeah, don't worry.
This is not the objection you're looking for.
Trust me. You know, like there is an objective foundation for the impartiality. For the, you know.
Right, right, yeah. And I assume that a lot more work gets done because of theories, and even though they have this protective blanket around them, you know. I like to think that although they're resistant to change, some of that resistance to change isn't unreasonable. I always tell students, you know, science, it's when an eighth grader or ninth grader takes chemistry for this first time and they don't replicate something that we all know to be true, you don't call the press, you know, and say, like, with disconfirmation. But this gets us to, I think, an important question, which is, you know, Greenwald is doing a good job of making the case that the system kind of needs this, right? There's no need to think of these biases as just a source of evil or bad intentions, or, you know, the part of the metaphor that he's not carrying is, you know, that totalitarians are assholes. It's simply that this is an efficient way to store information. But you do have to accept that there are times when change has to come. And so I got myself thinking a bit about how do we facilitate that change so that we're not double thinking? What do we do both in science and just as personal historians to make sure that we're not letting these biases get the best of us? And in science, at least, I think that we're trying a lot right now with, for instance, open science, where we're making sure that we make our data available, that we're upfront about the analyses that we're going to do so that we can't p-hack the shit out of it. And so there are institutional structures that are being built to ensure that we're not too biased, that we don't fall prey to believing what is wrong. But for the individual, it's a bit harder, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard even to get feedback about you being an asshole, right? Because
we talked a little bit about this with Valerie, right? Like, this reminds Aristotle, weirdly enough, had some thoughts on this. This was one of the reasons why he valued friendship so much, is friends give you an opportunity to get a not unbiased, but maybe less biased account of your behavior and your motives, Dad. And so a good friend can serve as a bit of a corrective, but not one that threatens to send you spinning into multiple personality.
Exactly. And you know, and you're just likely to trust the friend knows you and has the only the best intentions for you. Whereas if someone random tells me I'm an asshole, it may be true, but I certainly am going to dismiss it. Like,
right.
But if a good friend tells me that I acted in an asshole-ish way, like now I have to listen. Yeah.
And you have to think about it, and maybe you did. And I think this, like, a lot of relationships are like that. I mean, I see this, like, I'll start, like, yelling at Eliza for, you know, spilling something or, like, not paying attention because she's careless like I am. And you kind of find yourself, like, what are you doing? You know, but you justify – the justification machinery just kicks in so hard that you really have to make this – effort to overcome it, to just like chill out for a second and ask if your reaction is really justified.
Well, and you know, yeah, exactly. You know what's freaky is when you see that you're acting like your parents acted.
Yeah.
Right. And you're like, oh shit, man, I do not want to turn into the mistakes that my parents made.
Yeah.
And I often find myself just trying to disarm my daughter by admitting to her that what she did, I've done before.
Yeah, I do that too.
Yeah. Right.
And it's true. Or at least it's true. Believe
no,
it's true.
Yeah.
You know,
and that I've had to work against it.
Yeah, but you don't have to be as careless and clumsy and stupid as I am.
I still continue to be.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'll say that all the time. Like I'm trying to stop. It's part of the justifying for me getting so mad about something that I do all the time. But like you know, like it's like I really don't want her to.
Yeah, you know, I was reminded of the thinking about the flaws of my family. That I've had to work against in my own personality. I swear that the one and only reason my dad is willing to pay for someone to come clean his house once a week is so that he can blame it on her when he loses something. Like, it just serves the only function that serves for him was like the cleaning lady must have done something to it. Like,
yeah. I think that's like a universe. My dad would do that too. Like there's nothing that once we had a cleaning person come, there was, her name was Rosa. There was nothing that he lost and that Rosa was responsible.
Right. I'm like, you know, Rosa doesn't care about your toenail clipper. You know?
Speaking of like universal, I had a couple questions about this paper. One of them is how vulnerable some of these results and biases that he's talking about, how vulnerable they are to objections like Joe Henrich, you know, weird style objections these biases, because some of the biases, especially I guess the egocentricity ones, sound very much like the kind of biases you would expect in individualistic cultures, but maybe not as much in more collectivist cultures.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think that our understanding from, and there's just not enough work cross-culturally, but our understanding, for instance, of I know work on the fundamental attribution bias, right? The tendency to believe that others acted because of their disposition. There's a great article by Morris and Peng in, I think it was in the late 80s, early 90s, looking at Chinese versus American attributions for the acts of a murderer. So it was in both cases, in China and in the US, there was a student who brought a gun to their academic defense committee meeting and just like opened, just shot at their profession. It's not funny. It actually freaks me out. And what you find is, I think the understanding is that in collectivistic cultures, these biases are more likely to be group-centered rather than individual-centered. So the same biases exist, but in both the positive and negative way, you're likely to rewrite the information with the level of analysis being your group rather than you as an individual.
The fundamental attribution error, yeah, I remember talking with Zimbardo about this. They do it less in collectivist cultures when you're talking about the individual, at least.
Right.
And so in that sense, they are more accurate.
Yes.
They have a more accurate understanding of the, in this particular context, they have a more accurate understanding of the causes of human behavior. But if what you're saying is right, that they transfer it then to the groups, I wonder how the metaphor now gets, you know, even more complicated, because there's the individual, there's the group, there's the totalitarian, you know. So
yeah,
this is definitely back in the day where it seems like a lot of these studies were on college students in Toronto.
Totally.
and
I think that it is a different way to be biased. You know, there is a lot of focus on the self obviously in the West. But I think it might just be similar mechanisms where, you know, you're paying attention to information that is pro your group.
And that you can organize properly.
And you can organize, right. So the organizational function might be the same. It's just on a different unit of analysis.
The other question I had was, so there's towards the end is the first time really any kind of evolutionary explanation comes into play, but it's more of an analogy than it is some sort of explanation at the evolutionary level to why these processes would have been adaptive.
Right.
I'm wondering, you know, for some of our evolutionary psychology listeners, what would, you know, a hardcore evolutionary psychologist think about this paper?
Yeah, I think that his discussion of evolutionary mechanism was just an attempt to defeat the objection that a human organism couldn't be that way because objective evidence clearly is always better.
Right.
It wasn't so much of a very strong defense of the view that these things did evolve. And I think it's still a problem in the field where...
I mean, certainly some of the biases can help self-esteem, and aren't there, you know, there's some evolutionary advantage to having higher self-esteem than lower self-esteem, right?
You
see that in primates and...
Yeah, so, and there's this view that what self-esteem is like a little, it's like a little barometer to how likely your group is to find you acceptable. And so we want to be viewed as accepted by the group. And because group living was so important. So when you're feeling shitty, it's because there's a real reason that you should fear being ostracized by the rest of the group members, which would lead to death. I don't think that this stuff necessarily requires an evolutionary explanation. There's no reason to think that all of these biases are
they have adaptive explanations.
Yeah. They might just be a byproduct of say, you know, you only have one perspective, and maybe even just culturally bolstered, you want to see the self as important and good. And some of them might be evolutionarily adaptive, and some of them just might be a result of the kind of learning that occurs. There's actually this set of findings called depressive realism, that if you measure people's objective accuracy about their self abilities, that when they're depressed, they tend to be accurate. And the normal individual who's not currently feeling clinically depressed is actually like way off.
That's me.
Yeah.
I way overestimate my abilities at virtually everything.
And I just carefully structure my encounters in life so that nobody can disprove it.
You know. The only thing I'm right about in my estimation of my abilities is the ability to interpret Mr. Robot. There I'm accurate or in fact, maybe understating my...
Yeah, Paul was so livid, even at this conference, about how stupid it was that I thought that time travel could figure in. And
it was like a whole article about
I know. That. I told him, you know what, Paul? I didn't have a dog in this fight. But right now, I'm so hoping, just for the sake of my pride, that time travel comes into play next season. He's like, but that would ruin the show. And I'm like, I'm willing to sacrifice
the show
just so that I
can see the viewing experience of 10 million people.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. It's all about me and what Paul thinks about me. Yeah. And I wanted to quickly say, like, what I was really interested in was you know, again, this is a paper that I don't hear talked about that much.
Which is crazy.
It is crazy. Tony Greenwald, like I said, Mazarin did a little e-introduction. And he wrote right before the show, and he said, I do still consider the Totalitarian Ego article to be one of my best efforts ever, and its conclusions have more been built upon, including by me and Mazarin, than refuted or superseded. Looking back on it, I also see that it was one of the steps.
You would say that.
Yeah. Is being taken more by others than by me toward developing the ideas of implicit social cognition. At least he thinks highly of it. I'm curious as to whether he thought that it was influential in the field. I think it definitely was. In 1980, to have such a synthesis of the work on bias, you know, we now consider our field, we often call it social cognition, and it's like social psychology brought together with cognitive psychology. And you can see here that before that was ever a thing, it was present in this article that was like synthesizing multiple strands of evidence from very different, you know, the study of memory is its own thing. And bringing this all together was a really,
this is a great example of the downside of hyper specialization too. I mean, talk about so many different areas in the sciences, cognitive sciences, social science, but then all, and then, you know, like the political science, he doesn't claim to that this is original thought, but he helps himself to, you know, with his quotations from Arendt and Orwell to a theory of totalitarian regimes, and like, and then also like the Kuhnian philosophy of science, like it's just everything in one paper. And it is one of those things where I wish this was attempted more often, although probably it's very hard to pull off.
Yeah, I was going to say, my fear is that a paper like this just wouldn't get accepted,
or even be good. You know,
yeah. Like, I'm trying to think of any other sort of grand sweeping papers with a metaphor. And
the emotional dog and his rational tail.
That's
like
what
maybe.
I think is the best example in recent years of a big claim driven by this sort of central metaphor that unifies research from all sorts of different areas. But it's still not as big as this.
No, yeah. Right. It's very focused on social psychology, mm-hmm. and, you know, the sentimentalism versus rationalism debate. And there's a lot of interesting philosophy in there, but he doesn't take a stand on it.
Yeah. And I think that this is a tighter paper in the sense that he's really bringing together specific studies from different fields and unifying them in a way that feels like he was recognizing something in synthesis, not in a way that does not seem like he's selectively reporting the research that there's actually a great little footnote. Not a footnote, a parenthetical, where is it? Where he's talking about the tendency of scientists to only report evidence that's consistent with their theory. And in parentheses, he puts caveat lector, right? Yeah. Just so you know, I might be doing that.
Just to gush a couple, a little more, like, and also to encourage people to read this paper. It's so seamless the way it integrates the totalitarian stuff, the philosophy of science stuff, and the you know, the cognitive biases on the self. The way that's done is it's masterful, and I, you know, it's almost deceptively easy the way it all comes together. I imagine that's so hard, and also, like, it's not just cool that it's so sweeping, but it's actually helpful to understand at the level of the individual to have the metaphor of the totalitarian ideology. It's like a really helpful metaphor as a way of, you know, further illuminating the theory of the self that he's describing. So it's just
it's a great example of a metaphor that helps, that does exactly what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to, you know, it provides this template for which you can understand all of this stuff, and it gives you more information in just the use of the metaphor than you would otherwise have from just reading all of the findings themselves. And yeah, I think Mazarin said, you know, that the way he weaves this together with the quotes from, it's just really well done and hard.
It's hard, but it's not. It doesn't read hard. No, it reads so easy. Yeah. It's effortless the way it's done. But yeah, no, this is a model. Speaking of models, how about that Giselle? No, Robert Frank, my personal model for how to write a book, Passions Within Reasons, one of my favorite books. He emailed us, said he'd listen to our podcast
the same day we posted, which was just like, what a good guy.
But Frank, that was a bucket list email to get.
Yeah. He's a great guy. We're going to have him on the show when his new book comes out. All right, let's wrap this up.
Okay. Well, yeah, good job. I think we've done two good papers.
You know, it wouldn't be bad to have a paper that we seriously disappointed in.
Yeah, I know, because we're just fanboys.
Yeah, I know.
It's so cool the way Berlin.
We need to offend some people. You'll pick.
All right. Well, I'll do my best to pick something that we can be a little more. Well, I don't know if we want to be critical. Yeah, maybe. Yeah, maybe. All right. Later. Wait. Join us next time on the Very Bad Witches.
Very bad wizard.